Hey everyone, Tom Salemi here. Welcome back to the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. So we've got a great episode for you today. We'll be talking with Nick Damiano. He is the CEO of Andromeda Surgical. And I've been meeting so many new and fascinating surgical robotics companies over this past year between our Device Talks meetings and SRS. And it's just been really, really educational. And Andromeda Surgical is one of those for sure. I wasn't quite sure what the approach was, and Nick tells a good story. And Andromeda is really exploring an interesting model, including one where it's building a system that would be agnostic for the type of end user devices that would be used, kind of like Rob Surgical, which I saw in at SRS. So enjoy talking with Nick. Nick's been on the podcast before, but was happy to bring him back and retell his story. Before my conversation with Nick, I spoke with Brody Galloway, who is a young man I met up when he was in Boston. He was here for the Moonshot program that was put together by Santosh Iyer. And he's an impressive young man. And we'll talk about Envision MedTech. It's an effort that he spearheaded after his own ongoing experience with healthcare and with medtech, and I'll leave it at that. But he's really turned that experience into an incredible positive, and I think you should listen to the interview. And if you can help in what he's trying to do, please reach out to him. He's on LinkedIn, so connect with Brody Galloway. Even if you can't help, connect with Brody Galloway on LinkedIn. He puts up some really thoughtful stuff. And he's got an eye for medtech in the future, and that makes me happy. So listen to that interview. And then, of course, before that, Chris Newmarker is back with the Newmarker's Newsmakers in what has kind of a Life Imitates podcast sort of happenstance. So Chris and I recorded the Newsmakers at 10 o'clock Eastern this morning. I'll spoil it for you a little bit. One of the newsmakers centered around Baxter's really unfortunate troubles it's having with its facility in North Carolina due to Hurricane Helene. Obviously, it's having a great impact on the healthcare industry, feared shortages of IV bags and other supplies. So really underlined the supply chain sort of vulnerability that we felt during COVID. It feels like it's coming back during COVID and during some other hurricanes as well. So Baxter's doing everything it can, of course, to accommodate its customers and to ensure that the supply of medical supplies continues. As a result, and I found this out probably about 2 hours after Chris and I recorded this this Newmarker's Newsmakers, unfortunately, Baxter's won't be able to send its speakers to Device Talks West. That includes Heather Knight, who's Executive Vice President and Group President of Medical Products and Therapies. Includes a very interesting supply chain conversation that we're going to have. Chris Newmarker was going to lead. And it includes Cecilia Soriano, who's the president of Infusion Therapies and Technologies at Baxter International. So as you can imagine, the folks at Baxter are super busy, too busy to speak at a dopey conference that I put together. So completely understand their point. And really wish them the best. And they'll be a big part of Device Talks in 2025. They're great friends of ours now, great partners of ours now, I should say. And they participated in some of our connected health conversations. They were a big part of Device Talks Boston, and that will continue. So we at Device Talks wish the folks at Baxter all the best and look forward to having you at our future events. We've already made adjustments to the Device Talks West agenda. We, for the first time, had a lunch or afternoon keynote at Device Talks West, but we're going to move that afternoon keynote to the traditional opening day one slot that Heather Knight was going to occupy. So attendees will be able to hear from Mustafa Tulluhi, who is the MedTech Product Management Lead for NVIDIA. Perhaps you've heard of NVIDIA. It's obviously a company that's making a huge impact on the globe and in MedTech. And you're going to get an early glimpse or a sneak glimpse into the future of medical devices, software-defined, AI-enabled, and robotic. So that's the title of Mustafa Tulluhi, Dr. Mustafa Tulluhi's presentation. And that will be at 9:30 on October 16th. So this is we're fortunate to have such a deep bench, and this is why. This is why you have a deep bench. So it's going to be a great couple of days. Make sure you join us at Device Talks West, happening on October 16th and 17th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. I realize I've been looking at my microphone the whole time and not at the camera. So, hey, everybody. It's a pretty big microphone, though. It's kind of distracting. Anyway, that was for those folks who are watching this on video. If you're listening to a podcast, you have no idea what I'm looking at, so I'll just continue. So anyway, join us at Device Talks West. Use the code DTPOD25 to save 25%. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register. We don't have a Device Talks Tuesdays coming up this Tuesday. We put that off until after Device Talks West because we just have so much going on. But that'll be brought to you by TE Connectivity. Actually, it'll come in, it'll be part of our November programming. So no Device Talks Tuesdays coming up. And that's it, folks. Lots of news here, obviously. And enjoy this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Let's hit it. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
How are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. We're moving into fall, at least in Minneapolis. Like, nice little chilly morning. So.
Yeah, no, it's fall everywhere, Chris. We all use the same calendars for the most part.
We're kind of in the same latitude, you know?
I had a brisk fall walk with Daisy Dog this morning in the woods.
Nice. It was lovely. So. Oh, that's wonderful.
No bugs, cool temps. I'll take fall any day, all day long.
You haven't gotten a frost yet, though, right?
We have not gotten a frost yet.
Okay. I always love the first frost because all the mosquitoes are dead. It's just fantastic. It's like all of a sudden, you know what? I can walk in the woods without, having to worry about putting on DEET or whatever. You know, I can just, it's fantastic. So
I had a friend over this weekend, and he talked about mosquitoes. He said that he's reading a book and where he learned that mosquitoes were responsible for like half the deaths ever.
Yeah, they're out to get us.
Half the people who died in history of man died because of mosquitoes.
I could see that. I mean, malaria.
We got to take care of this threat.
Malaria, dengue fever. Yeah. I saw we had some dengue fever spreading in the U.S. this year. Like somebody said, I had one of the neighbors there's some dang fever making its way into the upper Midwest. I'm like, that's what killed Panama Canal workers 100 years ago.
Just have good old West Nile and Eastern equine encephalitis.
So. I don't want to get sick old school. I mean, come on. Your great grandpa had that. Did he survive? I don't know. He didn't. He was gone. Yeah, that's how your great great grandpa, The good old days when, you could just count on cholera or malaria or, all that good stuff.
This conversation has taken a dark turn.
Well, we do have Halloween coming up,
Have Halloween coming up. We also have Device Talks West coming up.
Yes.
Let's brighten
Much
our
better, yes.
Much better.
Much
not,
better.
Not a lot of mosquitoes in Santa Clara.
No. Yeah, never swatted a mosquito away outside of the convention center in Santa Clara. So,
yeah, if you're October 16th and 17th at the Santa Clara
convention. Autumn weather is chilling you. Like, come to sunny Santa Clara and look at the palm trees and then come in and, learn about some great med tech.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're looking forward to that. We'll be there. Chris will be there. Yeah. I'll be there. We'll be leading discussions along with Kayleen Brown.
I mean, Toronto, it's probably cold there. Do they have poutine in Toronto? I can wait. It can wait.
We don't need to mention anything else that's going on around that time.
Get some tacos in Santa Clara.
The only thing we should all be focused on is Device Talks.
Device Talks West, man. That's where it's at.
Absolutely. All right, Chris.
All right, man.
So we've had a an interesting week for the Southeast, but
yes.
For the medical device industry as well. But totally. in some troubling news, it's been it's kind of recurring in medtech. So let's hit the Newmarker's Newsmakers, Chris. What's number five? on this award-winning list.
Number five, just, you know, actually, this is a great roundup from Associate Editor Sean Hooley of the top 10 surgical robotics stories of the year so far. This is a mass device. So, you know, if you want to catch up and make sure you've, you know, learned of all the top news so far this year's in this, like, really hot space, I mean, check out this article. And just got to also mention, we'll have a lot of great robotic surgery technology, you know, sessions at Device Talks West. And we will stop shamelessly plugging our show now, but we have a whole host of...
We'll absolutely not stop shamelessly.
We got to keep on going. You're right. Yeah.
Buckle up, people. Put on some rain gear, because we're going to be...
No.
It's a great roundup by Sean. And at the very bottom, we have the intro video for Team Surgical Robotics. We've got our MedTech March to Device Talks West. And we do have indeed a lot of great speakers at Device Talks West related to surgical robotics. We'll have presentations by Virtual Incision. And we'll be talking in this episode, I'll be talking with Nick Damiano of Andromeda Surgical, which has a very cool cool new surgical robotics system that they're developing. But we'll also have NDATX, and we'll have someone from NVIDIA talking about how NVIDIA is working in the space. And we'll have Savada Health. So just we'll post the video on there. We've got surgical robotics pretty much going on throughout the day, and it's also our conference rather is related or located adjacent to our Robo Business meeting. So we will have plenty of robotics talk at Device Talks West, no doubt.
Fantastic. And we also are rolling out a bunch of other top stories on like roundups on Massive Device this week. I mean, just a lot of top things. I had a roundup of top connected health news. Sean had a roundup of top neurological tech news. I think today, Friday, we're rolling out our senior editor, Daniel Kirsch, is rolling out a roundup of top women's health news. So this is the week to get some top news roundups on Mass Device and catch yourself up.
Absolutely. And going back to surgical robotics, we also have Moon Surgical, and I'm excited to hear from Laza Medical, which is a Shifa Med company that's working in the structural heart space. So really new, cool new applications for surgical robotics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like amazing all the different things that we're finding out they're trying to employ, you know, surgical robotics with. So it's an exciting time. It's, you know, and then hopefully we'll, you know, spread the amount of, you know, like, you know, surgical know-how that we can have across the country.
Absolutely. All right, Chris Newmarker, what's number four?
Number four
on this vaunted list.
We've got Medtronic launching its Vital Flow ECMO system. That's an extracorporeal membrane oxygenation system. This is it's basically, you know, basically like an artificial lung. This is an interesting story too, because this technology, Medtronic acquired it. It's kind of snuck in below the radar here. They purchased MC3 Cardiopulmonary in March. Which they said was like a culmination of like an 8-year partnership they'd had with them, but they're bringing that tech in-house, as part of their Medtronic cardiac surgery business. And now we've got the rollout of a Vital Flow, which is this configurable one system ECMO system. And they said they designed this for simplicity and performance.
Well, that's exciting news from Medtronic. Nice to see them still busy in the acquisition space, and nice to talk about some good old fashioned traditional med tech like the cardiac surgery portfolio. So great addition by Medtronic. And I see they also mentioned in the release work they do with Viant medical contract manufacturing site. So yeah, Viant's a good supporter of Device Talks. So good to see Viant mentioned as well. All right, Chris Newmarker, what is number three?
Well, number three on the list, we've got ResMed launching a new sleep apnea mask that has like a tube up design to it. The AirTouch N30i. So it's like designed the new mask created like kind of like a natural and comfortable sleep experience for people with sleep apnea, and you know, like the maths are very important. I mean, I think that I imagine that's probably one of the challenges and hurdles to get people to use CPAPs. It's like, you know, you've got this apparatus attached to your face while you're sleeping at night. So, you know, any kind of improvements sound great. You know, and they're saying this is like a fabric wrapped frame and it's soft. They're saying it's soft, it's breathable, moisture wicking design. I think we'd like to actually, it'd be really interesting to reach out to ResMed and find a little more about how they does this design like reduce the use of magnets, because I know that's been kind of a challenge around CPAP masks is, you know, the magnets that, you know, have held previous generations of them together. So, I mean, like how they might interact with implantable devices. So, I mean, that's something they've been working at as well, but this definitely looks like a more user-friendly design, that you kind of like have this plastic thing, you know, wrapped over the top of your head, you know, while you're wearing it. But
it's hard to convey in a podcast, but looking at the photo that we have on Mass Device, and again, this is an article written by Sean Hooley. It's a lot less obtrusive than a traditional mask would be, which you're right, is the biggest hurdle that I think a lot of folks have with the CPAP devices. No news there. So any improvements you can make there for sure.
You know, we had other big
speed adoption.
Yeah, that's awesome. And we have other big ResMed news this week too. We've had them launching a whole new portfolio. You know, they had new patient-centric products, you know, to kind of like these like digital health ads to, you know, what they're offering. You know, with for sleep apnea, you know, including like they've got their, they discuss their MyAir, consumer app, over the years, I've noticed ResMed has been, they've definitely been like kind of on one of the companies really on the forefront of these digital health offerings. Absolutely. You know, so, I mean, this looks like them just like, you know, pushing this even further, forward, and it looks like it even like they're even using a sleep staging data from Apple Health and Health Connect, you know, to work with MyAir, so that you can get your Apple Watch in on the action, you know, with this.
No, and if anyone wants insights on that, the interview I did with Jim Hollingshead, who's now CEO of Insulet, he built the whole digital strategy, connected care strategy at ResMed.
That's fantastic,
and really, really, to your point, Christy, I always knew I knew that they were seen as leaders in this space. I didn't completely understand why until I did that interview. So if folks want some more insights on connected health, can listen to that. And of course, he's at Insulet now, helping them devise their connected strategy for Omnipod. So
fantastic. Yeah, both that CPAP space as, you know, with ResMed, as well as that, that diabetes space, my gosh, with insulin pumps and CGMs. I mean, both of those, I think, really have stood out as areas where they're just packaging like all kinds of like these interactive digital health features to help people track their health. And, you know, both sleep apnea and diabetes, I mean, those are both, you know, conditions where people really, really want to be, you know, following their data.
All right. Fantastic. Let us roll on to, I think we're on number two.
Right? Number two on the list. Number two, we unfortunately have, looks like we're heading potentially into another, you know, some kind of layoff season with MedTech. We had, you know, two stories on Mass Device this week about layoffs, you know, the big one being Johnson & Johnson laying off more than 200 employees, you know, in New Brunswick, which is where their headquarters is. You know, we also have like, you know, Stryker laying off more workers at a plant in Florida that they plan to close by the end of 2026, and that'll by the time that's closed in 2026, we'll have laid off roughly 500 workers there. So just some unfortunate news. You know, it's like definitely, I mean, the Fed's starting to cut rates because, you know, like, you know, they've been noticing a softening in the job market. Though I will have to say, as we're talking here on Friday, you know, the new job data shows that the U.S. added 254,000 jobs in the past month, which surpassed expectations. So, I mean, it's still, you know, we, fingers crossed, maybe we'll get still get that soft landing that, you know, the Fed's been talking about that seemed really hard to get. But we'll just have to keep on watching this.
And there seem to be a lot of other companies that are hiring as well in tech. So
totally.
It's more of a realignment than anything else. And
you get near the end of the year, you always see companies starting to do some adjustments and whatnot.
It's not great, especially if you're sort of it just gives credence or really demonstrates the wisdom in just managing your career and ensuring that you're always sort of looking and planning and thinking about what's next for yourself.
Totally.
Because these things can come out of nowhere sometimes, and they can be really, really traumatic for folks. So
totally.
I do feel for everyone who's lost their jobs, but I'm confident that there are other jobs out there for them. So especially in the medtech industry.
You know, I noticed that Joe Mullings of the Mullings Group had a post on LinkedIn this week where he was, you know, Joe Stradamus was saying that he was saying there was going to be a round of layoffs in medtech. But I mean, he was kind of giving like that kind of advice, you know, like, hey, you know, like you gotta kind of be entrepreneurial with your career and like figure out how you're building stuff, and it can be, you know, an opportunity to try new things. But yes, you can't, it's not like the old days when, my grandpa back in Ohio, like worked at a pet food factory his whole life. That just doesn't work that way anymore.
No, it does not. No, it does not. So, good luck to all those folks who have been impacted. I'm sure you'll find something. And reach out to us on LinkedIn, Chris and I, and just let us know how you're
totally.
Doing.
Yes.
If we can help, we will.
Absolutely.
All right, Chris Newmarker, troubling number one as well. Why don't you roll?
Yeah, I mean, just really, just horrible news out of the southeast with the effects of Hurricane Helene, and this also had an effect on medtech. I mean, specifically that Baxter, their largest factory, was in North Carolina, their North Cove site in Marion, North Carolina, you know, in the mountains. And it's shut down now. I mean, bridges washed out in the area, like
wow.
all kinds of problems. And I've got a story that I wrote earlier this week about that on Medical Design Outsourcing. I'm going to be updating, you know, today, as Baxter had a news release saying like they didn't still have an ETA of when they'll be able to get that plant online. It sounded like they had put in a temporary bridge to try to get out. I mean, these are like IV bags and supplies like this. And this is like one
right.
of the main producers of that for the United States. So, I mean, there's already media reports around the country right now of health providers starting to figure out ways to try to like control the use of those, you know, so we don't have a shortage because, you know, people need those to stay alive.
Yeah, we have something in the Globe today about that, patients getting Gatorade instead of IVs if they're obviously just need some replenishment.
Yeah.
About some other certain changes to SOPs that they're doing to save on bags. So hopefully it'll sort itself out before the supply crunch is really hit, because obviously you can't think of any more critical piece of equipment than an IV bag for the health and care of patients.
Yeah, I mean, Baxter is saying too that they're working with FDA to try to draw more on their international network, but you know, so hopefully things move quickly on that as well. But it sounds like the FDA needs to figure out what to do with that as well. Like, I mean, so maybe there are some international resources Baxter drawing, but it sounds like they need to get an FDA green light that they're cool with those products coming into the U.S. Our medical design outsourcing managing editor, Jim Hamran, just like a few years ago had an article, like as the pandemic was ending, pointing out like, yes, you know, all the supply chain problems with the pandemic were starting to wrap up, but, you know, climate change was going to present an ongoing crisis for the industry. And my gosh, what's happening at Baxter is just a great example of that. I mean, who knew, like, you know, you're in the middle of the mountains, you can, like, a hurricane that dumps a ton of rain can just cause a horrific amount of damage. So we're nobody's immune to climate change. I used to have the wishful thinking that I was, you know, safer up in Minnesota, because I'm like, wow, we got really cold winters. And it's like why is all there this wildfire smoke from Canada in the air? You know, you just
back to the mosquito-borne illnesses. Let's circle back to the beginning of our conversation.
Yes, we'll have to like the
times they are.
We got
a
party like
sure.
It's 1899.
And if anyone who's listening saw the image I posted on LinkedIn, Chris Neumarker disappeared because he had to go talk to
yes.
the sprinkler guy.
Yes. So. Tis the season. Like,
tis the season.
Winter is coming, right, Tom. Well, winter is coming.
Chris Neumarker, we have one more episode until Device Talks West, and then we'll see each other in Santa Clara. So have a
too,
great
man.
Friday, buddy.
You too, buddy. Great to see you in 2 weeks. Take care, everybody.
Hello, Device Talkers. It's Kayleen Brown, Managing Editor of Device Talks. We are so thrilled to bring you our Women in MedTech Luncheon happening at Device Talks West, October 17th. So from 12:15 to 1:15 p.m., we are bringing together women in the medical device industry and our allies for a one-hour networking session. So please, please, please join us on October 17th at Device Talks West for the Women in MedTech Luncheon. And a huge thank you to our generous, generous sponsors, Aptix, Capstan Medical, GlobalLogic, Integer Holdings, and Westfall Technic. We couldn't host our networking session if it weren't for your huge support. So thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you for supporting female leadership in the medical device industry. For more information, and of course to register, please go to west.devicetalks.com. I'll see you October 17th.
Well, Brody Galloway, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Tom. So excited to be here.
It's good to talk to a young person interested in medtech, and I'm eager to have folks hear your story. What was the first thing that kind of drew you into the medtech industry, Brody?
Well, I've been around it my whole life as a patient with CHD. I was born with a congenital heart defect called truncus arteriosus. Mm-hmm. I've had 10 surgeries my whole life, 3 open heart, 7 cath procedures, been followed by a cardiologist my whole life. So I've been always had my foot in the medtech industry and the medical field.
So having those experiences as a patient, we'll get into what you've turned that sort of inspiration into, a really great effort. But I could see two different directions, someone being completely turned off by medical devices and by healthcare and just wanting to go away in the other direction, or perhaps doing what you're doing, which is kind of leaning into it. What was it about the medtech industry that drew you in, other than the fact it's been, a life-saving effort for you in all the procedures you've gone through?
Yeah, well, I've really always been into engineering and problem solving. The medicine side hasn't interested me as much. When I had my echo procedures where they used the scope to look at my heart from the outside, I was always like asking questions and how are they seeing my heart from out here? Things like that. Mm-hmm. And that kind of sparked my interest on the engineering side and problem solving and innovation. So through middle school, I went at a pre-engineering program and started my engineering career. So not necessarily medicine. I was surrounded by it. I wasn't quite leaning into it at an earlier age. But that's a good question. You know, like many people might be more scared of doctors because of their experience. And I really was never affected in that way. I was at a children's hospital, so all the nurses were always super nice to me. So it wasn't the worst time being there.
That's a really nice outlook to have. So what have you turned your experience into? Talk a bit about what you've built and partly why you're here today. You've got some requests of the medtech industry.
Yeah, so I was really interested in the medical device field. I started writing about devices I found interesting around my freshman year of high school. And as I wrote more and more, I'm like, okay, I share this on LinkedIn, right? So I started posting on LinkedIn, but I wanted a more community-based area where I could share my findings and share the medical device industry to my classmates and student body. So that's where I started Envision MedTech, and that was the club. That was to show the opportunities of what MedTech could offer to students and the future, both in clinical areas, engineering, regulatory, all those different aspects. My sophomore year, I had my seventh cath procedure. I needed a stent placed in.
Oh, really?
And yeah, so I got in contact with a former nurse and a nurse at the time, because she was working the ICU, and she was sharing how many of the patients were flown in from neighboring countries because they didn't have access to both the necessary pediatric medical technology, but also the skilled clinicians. And given my high interest in med tech at the time, my writing in the club, I was like, okay, that's a problem. And I didn't quite know where to go with it quite yet. And then, but she got me in contact with the founder of Helping Hands for Honduras, and he shared what he needed. We got on a call, and I said, yeah, I can do that. Before I knew how or what I would need to do, I said, yeah, we can do that. And he sent me what he needed, and we got to work.
So was it a list of equipment? Is that what he sent over?
Yeah, he sent a list of about 75 different devices / tools that would be needed to treat patients in Honduras.
So what on earth possessed you to say, yeah, I can do that? I mean, I don't know if I could find 75 pieces of medical equipment, and I've been covering the industry for 25 years.
Well, it wasn't as binding as it might seem. They already had a source of devices, so it was more of a, let me learn how to do this and let me see what I can do. I didn't want to come out with nothing. So we worked hard, and I got in contact with more of my former nurses, and we collected 1,000 devices that ended up helping save 13 lives in Honduras in August. Wow.
That's amazing. So what kind of devices, a few examples, what kind of devices are we talking about?
So this one was an open heart mission. However, okay, we did collect a lot of cardiac catheters. We did Foley catheters, a lot of surgical and ICU supplies that was needed in the OR. We didn't get diagnostic devices or like the higher level equipment. We were mainly working on like the stuff that is FDA expired in the U.S. because in the U.S. they cap out a lot of the equipment, but it can be used in other areas like Honduras.
Interesting. So you're in the midst of collecting devices now for another mission trip, right? Tell folks what you're looking for.
So right now we're collecting things that would be used for a catheter mission trip in January, like cardiac catheters, any IVs, things like that are great. Any ICU equipment for pediatrics is wonderful. So yeah, that's a lot of the stuff that we're looking for right now.
And so you're hoping to do you get this generally from device manufacturers or from hospitals who have them lying around? What is your primary source of donated equipment?
Right now our main source is through hospitals. We collected our equipment through Nicholas Children's Hospital, and we collected from Palms West. Those two hospitals contributed, and I still have some devices behind me that will be used for January. But yeah, just so far we've been focused on hospitals, but as we progress and we have more capital and we make more connections, we want to establish more partnerships with manufacturers and companies that would be willing to provide equipment and funding for these trips.
That's fantastic. I'll post the I'll post the information you're looking for on LinkedIn. Folks can find that on my LinkedIn, and they can also find you, Brody Galloway, on LinkedIn as well. They should connect with you there. Final question: what is your what are your plans for the future? You're in an exciting time in your life.
Yeah. So for Envision MedTech, we want to continue the helping out Helping Hands for Honduras. They're a great organization. We trust them. They fly out their clinicians from the Cardiac Institute at in Mexico. So that their staff is highly skilled. That's a world-class institute. So we can trust them with the equipment we send. And then we want to continue helping them. We also, once we get more funding, buy those better tools to continue providing them. And then once we establish a good pipeline of devices, we can expand our reach. And then also, I'm going on these trips not only for these devices, but also to share my story. So when a patient sees their, or sorry, when a family member or a parent sees their baby in such a poor position or a vulnerable position, mm-hmm. it's difficult for the parents. And for me to be able to share my personal story and how far I've come, and I was once in that child's position, it instills a lot of hope and empowers them to get through the hardships of having a patient with CHD. We want to continue sharing my story and instilling hope in that way, and then also providing the devices. And then as I am a student as well, so I have college next year.
Yeah, what are your plans? Give some career aspirations at this point?
I want to major in biomedical engineering. That's going to set me up well for what I want to do in the industry. Definitely go into the medtech industry. I'm not heart set on a particular college. I'm looking at many. But yeah, those are my plans.
Well, it's exciting stuff. You've already got a great accomplishment under your belt, and as a dad, I can certainly say that seeing you thrive and contribute would certainly give me hope if I were in that unfortunate position that you described. So it's great that you're doing that. It's great that you're actually helping people, and look forward to talking to you in a decade or so when you're doing something fantastic in the medtech industry.
Thank you, Tom.
This is Tom Salami of Device Talks. We're excited to bring you another great program for Device Talks West here at the Santa Clara Convention Center, talking new business models, new missions, and new intentions. I can't wait until we fill this auditorium with MedTech's best engineers, entrepreneurs, and executives. This is Device Talks West.
The foundation of connected care is the who we are that drives the what we do. We shape our environment, and then our environment shapes us.
Thoughtful discussions of how it impacts not only markets, but society and the workforce.
What is it doing for the patient? And that's what our technology needs to be.
I look at what the standard of care is today. Are there areas where we can improve upon the standard of care, or are there areas where there are significant gaps? And that's what drives me.
What am I trying to accomplish? You know, getting back to that core, what problem am I trying to solve? Am I going to do something new and really move the needle for patient outcomes? So there's a ton of work to be done, and that's what keeps me excited.
Why did you choose MedTech? Find out at Device Talks West on October 16th and 17th. Register at west.devicetalks.com.
The folks that are saving lives, they're all here.
Nick Damiano, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here, Tom.
I'm excited to have you at Device Talks West. You'll be presenting in our engineering theater, telling a bit of Andromeda Surgical's story. We've had you on the podcast before when you were CEO of Zenflow. I think we've covered your background a little bit about your approach into medtech, but maybe we could just bring folks a little bit up to speed. What was What drew you to the medtech sector, and how did you find your way to lead startups?
Yeah, so I was going to be a surgeon initially. My dad was a surgeon, and you know, I felt like it was something I would be interested in. And so went to college and, you know, started as pre-med then, and this is at Stanford, and I got kind of sucked into the startup scene while I was there and eventually came to the realization that I'd prefer to go into tech, but wanted to stay close to patient care and healthcare. And so decided to become an engineer and then work for medtech startups. And then after kind of going through the ups and downs of a startup as an engineer for a few years, decided to take matters in my own hands and become a founder. And now I've been a founder now with three startups over the last, I think, more than 12 years at this point.
Do you think you would have been enjoyed being a surgeon?
I think I would have. I really like using the surgery simulator we have at the office here. And, you know, it would have been fun in certain ways, but I have no doubt that this was the right path. And I mean, just all the, I think both the training that goes into it and the rigidity and the hierarchy in medicine is a little bit tough for my personality. I prefer to be a founder and, you know, kind of shape my own destiny and build things.
Yeah, they do feel like different worlds or different ways of spending your time. Both doing good, but in very different ways. And you did the Stanford Biodesign program as well, right?
I did. Yeah, that was really good. I mean, really got me started and networked well in medtech.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great, great, great start. So let's get into the company and Andromeda. First, before we get into the juicy stuff about the tech, how did you come to settle on wanting to start the company and lead a surgical robotics company?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, it didn't really follow the biodesign pathway where you start with a need at the beginning. It was more of a meta need where having been in med tech for a while, I realized that a lot of times when you're in the operating room, things don't go according to plan, and there are challenges that come up where the outcomes often aren't as good as you'd hope they would be. So there was this meta need of making surgery just safer, easier, more error-proof. And so I met with my co-founder through the Y Combinator network. We had both been former founders from Y Combinator. I was there with Zenflow, and he was there with a company called Starsky Robotics, which was a autonomous truck company, and he had actually built the first autonomous truck that ever drove on a highway without a person behind the wheel. So had a really interesting background, and we had both been thinking about the need to make surgery better. And I think he also was kind of thinking that, we built this technology for this autonomous driving technology for vehicles. Why couldn't we do it for other spaces? And one that he was looking at independently before we even met was surgery. So we'd both been thinking about this from different angles, me from medtech, him from autonomous vehicles. And we just got to brainstorming about whether we could actually build this and what it would take to do that. And then also realizing that we couldn't just go and build a general purpose autonomous surgical robot. We needed to figure out where to start. Mm-hmm. So the first step we decided to undertake was just talking to surgeons and looking for needs. So then kind of backing into the biodesign process. Mm-hmm. And I knew a lot of urologists, having built a company before this in urology. And so we talked to maybe 15, 20 surgeons over a few weeks, and most of them were urologists. And then we ended up finding a really compelling need in urology that we thought was really promising from a need standpoint, and just the market dynamics made a lot of sense. So we decided to go down that path, and we've stayed on the path ever since. We've, you know, kind of also figured out that there's a lot of needs in endourology that we could address. Mm-hmm. So there's also some promising kind of second and third indications we could go for.
Interesting. So I'm sure people listening hear the words autonomous, surgical, and robot, and their curiosity has got to be peaked, and I put them directly in that order. So let's get into that's the how you got together. Let's get into what you're working on. Tell us what Andromeda Surgical is up to.
Yeah. So as I said, at a high level, it's autonomous surgical robots. Yep. So we believe that, I mean, whereas robotics have been taking over surgery over the last couple of decades, especially in recent years, that the next step is going to be AI and autonomy for kind of augmenting these robots and making, not just making surgery physically easier, but also mentally, cognitively easier. Mm-hmm. So we feel like there's a lot more outcome improvement that can happen from adding AI and autonomy in kind of the same way it's been added to vehicles, to surgical robots. And so, yeah, we're generally building that. We're building it in steps where we're not going to just release a fully autonomous, if you know the self-driving terminology, level 5 self-driving robot right away. We're going to build a robot first that's got some kind of driver assist features. Mm-hmm. Like if you know, and we use a lot of vehicle analogies where you go from driving to driving with a GPS, and then we will layer on as we go and, you know, gain experience, collect data, we'll layer on more and more autonomy features. And the first indication, as I mentioned, is in urology. We're starting with a procedure called holmium laser enucleation of the prostate, or HOLEP. It's a BPH procedure. It's got really the best outcomes, both in terms of safety and effectiveness, as far as surgical treatments go. And it's really the only procedure that's a true cure for BPH besides taking the whole prostate out. We found lots of surgeon enthusiasm behind HOLEP in the last, especially the last 10 years, where it's really growing at a tremendous rate, even without us or anybody really marketing this. So good sign that surgeons are adopting this rapidly, despite the fact that there's really not much industry push behind it.
Describe, if you would, for me, the surgical robotic system. Were we talking about a larger system that has the arms and that is moving autonomously, or are you approaching this with a different design in mind?
Yeah, I mean, the hardware is very simple. One thing we've set up to do as a company is focus as much as possible on the software, which is kind of unusual for surgical robots, mm-hmm. where the hardware is usually and in med tech in general, the hardware is a big focus. Yep. People are more hardware oriented than software. So we've taken some off the shelf parts. We have an off the shelf arm, and then we've found a kind of general purpose cart that we mounted on. And then what we do is make this custom adapter that just holds the surgical tools that are already out there. So we're not playing the disposables game, mm-hmm. like most robotics play. We're just using tools that already exist, which has made the hardware really simple. And one big benefit of working with things that are already being used in the surgical treatment is that we can partner with, you know, the scope companies, the laser companies, it's a laser procedure, to really help us much more easily access the market, since they're already out there selling to the same customers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's mostly off the shelf, pretty simple. And then the big differentiator, the big value is being added with the software.
And what is the need? Where do we need, or where in urology is an autonomous procedure going to be helpful?
Yeah, so for this first HOLEP indication, we've seen that this procedure is tremendously safe and effective. Mm-hmm. The results really speak for themselves. But then the challenge is the learning curve. So the reason why this is only 10% of procedures and not 80% is because it's just an incredible amount of effort required to train, and it's really stressful. So just learning how to do this procedure, how to do an enucleation of the prostate instead of a typical resection is kind of counterintuitive and hard to learn for urologists. Mm. So you have to go through this. It's been reported about 50 cases to learn this procedure, even at a basic level. And then we found that the first few hundred cases can be really stressful and difficult for urologists. So that's what's keeping people from adopting this procedure is the learning curve. Mm. And so we felt like we could really reduce that. A lot of the things that are hard about the procedure, the kind of spatial orientation and the plane recognition where you're trying to identify certain anatomical features, could be done a lot more easily with a robot and with AI guidance. So we've been able to show already in the first less than year and a half of the company that we're able to add a lot of value as far as helping the surgeons with those hard parts of the procedure. Hmm.
So what is the stressful part and the challenging part? Is it the fact that you're just the limited area in which you're working in, and that there's the small amount of tissue that you want to strike with the laser, and you don't want to stray too far from that? What creates the stress for the surgeons?
Yeah, I mean, you're striking this balance between going too far out where you cut through the capsule of the prostate, mm-hmm. which is is not a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the main thing you're avoiding when you're doing the enucleation. And also, if you're too conservative and you go too far in, then you're not going to remove all the tissue and it can regrow and cause problems later on. Mm-hmm. So you want to strike that balance and really follow this plane. The procedure is often likened to coring out an orange from the inside, where you're removing the pulp from the peel, and the pulp's the enlarged tissue called the adenoma. It's more in a lot of ways more like an onion, where there's different possible false layers, where you want to enucleate a certain plane but not the wrong plane. Mm-hmm. And when surgeons are new to the procedure, they get lost and they often go along the wrong path. Then they have to kind of go back and find where they were. And once you create all these erroneous cuts, then you end up making a mess of it, and it's harder and harder to go back and reestablish yourself in the right plane. Mm-hmm. So it becomes worse and worse as you make more and more mistakes. So even with our first generation, which we've already built, we have this GPS-like navigational guidance where they can see where they are compared to all the landmarks, all the anatomical features, and really remain oriented in the right plane and keep progressing in the right direction towards the eventual goal, which is the bladder neck, where you end up at the end. Mm. Lots of value even in that. And then as we go, we'll build more and more features to make it even easier.
So where do you draw the insights to inform your software to understand what needs to be part of the procedure, what tissue does need to be part of the procedure? Are you working with skilled surgeons in this, or sort of teaching your system, or is your system basing itself strictly on love GPS sort of element, as it's able to read the area better than maybe a human eye can, and can help really, again, direct the procedure more effectively?
Yeah, so we've been working with a lot of the leading surgeons in this procedure since the beginning. Mm-hmm. I've known the surgeon who invented the procedure down in New Zealand, named Peter Gilling, has been very, very actively involved and enthusiastic. And I knew him before this company from my prior company. He's kind of the top global thought leader. He's actually going to do the first cases when we do our first human studies soon. And then just a lot of other surgeons around the world have been actively involved in development. They've also been providing video data for our AI training. So one key thing you have to do to build the AI is to collect data from procedures that are being done manually out there. So we're not creating new procedures. We're just taking procedures that are already really great in terms of outcomes and making them better and easier. So we've been out there partnering with lots of urologists around the world and collecting video data that's going to be used to train our algorithms.
Okay. So autonomous surgical robotics has been tried in the past by other companies, or at least initially pursued and then abandoned and because there was seemingly a reluctance for an adoption of autonomous surgical robotics, that people weren't quite ready for that yet. What helps you, what makes you believe you can sort of cross that bridge when others haven't? And granted, those were founded a few years ago, and this technology does move quickly, but what makes you feel that you have a better chance at success?
Yeah, the timing's really good now. There's a lot more acceptance of AI in our everyday lives, mm-hmm. and autonomy, both from the ChatGPTs of the world, which people are using pretty regularly now. It's kind of made it mainstream. And then more on the line of AI this is not a large language model. It's not the same thing as ChatGPT. It's more like your traditional machine learning that's being used in technology like autonomous vehicles. Mm-hmm. So we've also seen that if you're in the Bay Area, at least, or a few other cities, you see the Waymo cars all over the place that are driving autonomously with no human behind the wheel. You've got people that own Teslas have full self-driving now, where it's able to get from almost, flawlessly from point A to point B by itself. So that's definitely a trend that's happening in the background. We've also been able to build a team from that space. A lot of our people are from autonomous vehicles. So they've really built this in another vertical already. Mm-hmm. And then on the surgeon side, so I think that background trend does help. We found that first of all, urologists are just generally tech savvy and want to adopt new things, mm-hmm. including robots. Da Vinci, of course, got started in the urology space early on. And then I think you have to also build it in the right way that, so this stepwise approach really helps, where what we're launching at first is not such a crazy huge step from where they are now. It's kind of similar to robots that are out there in the existing market. And then as we go and we add more autonomy, we're going to take it step by step. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be a huge leap from one generation to the next. And then also one thing that's really key is the human is going to be in the loop. It's not going to be, for the foreseeable future, it's not going to be you press a button and walk away and the whole surgery gets done. You're going to have the urologist there actively involved. It's more like autopilot in a plane where the surgeon's going to be at the console. They can always take over mm-hmm. or adjust as it's going. It's not just going to, the AI is not just going to go rogue and run by itself.
No, that's a great point. And great point about Da Vinci. Is this a procedure that Da Vinci is used for? Are you going up against Da Vinci, or is this something that Da Vinci isn't appropriate for?
It's not being used for this. There's a kind of a similar procedure that's more invasive called robotic simple prostatectomy, okay. which is something you can do with Da Vinci. If you can enucleate endoscopically with HoLEP, you would almost certainly do that because it's just less invasive and has fewer complications. It's not really in any real way a competitor of Da Vinci at this point. We're all endoscopically focused for this first indication, even the ones after that. We're not going head to head with them, which is good because as if you've seen the companies that have tried to go head to head with Da Vinci, it's been a really tough go.
Yeah, for sure. And what impact would a successful product have on the market? Do you see that now there's, I think you said the percentage earlier, what percentage of urologists are capable of doing this procedure? Do you see that increasing by 3x or 4x because now more of the surgeons who maybe weren't able to do it before now have the tools and the assistance they need to do it effectively?
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly a lot of demand for HoLEP. It's something that mm-hmm. urologists have been very eager to adopt. When you look at the training courses, they're full and booked up months or even a year ahead of time in a lot of cases. So there is this huge groundswell of interest. We do see this becoming the dominant procedure for surgical BPH treatment. I think a lot of urologists would agree with that. If HoLEP were easier, that would be the gold standard option, just because the outcomes are so much better. We think there's a lot of room to grow from the current roughly 10% of procedures that are HoLEP, and we certainly see it being the majority of procedures once we get this deployed.
And just final questions about the company itself. How have you been? How have you done with financing? Where are you with rounds raised? And what are your needs in the future? Do you have a sense of that yet?
Yeah, so we founded the company in April of last year. Mm-hmm. So it's oh, wow. been less than a year and a half okay. so far. We raised a pre-seed and seed round last year. I think we've totaled up to a little under $7 million in total funding. So we've tried to be relatively lean. Robotics are always expensive, and it takes a lot of people to build both the robotics and the AI stuff that we're building. We are going to be opening a Series A fairly soon, mm-hmm. so that'll be happening this year, and that's also lining up with our first in human studies. So we're going to be in the clinic pretty soon, and so we can look forward to an announcement of that after it happens.
Interesting. And final question: your ability to use any surgical, not your decision not to build a surgical tool business, but rather a sort of assistive surgical robotic business. What opportunities does that open up for you in terms of partnership? How do you think this would be sold differently than perhaps other surgical robotics? We've seen another company, Rob Surgical, that has sort of a same open approach to it. I guess this would feel more like you're selling a medical device than a surgical robotic system. You're like sort of selling another way to assist in a procedure, but you're not connecting a surgeon or a healthcare facility with all of your instruments and all of your tools. It's a really long and convoluted question, but how is this a different business than perhaps a surgical robotic system, surgical robotics yeah. company that has created its own tools, its own whatevers that need to be used as part of that system?
I mean, when you think about it from a first principle standpoint, we didn't see a need to create new tools yeah. for the procedure. The ones that are being used work great. And as I said, it's a little bit easier to access the market when you can partner with them instead of competing with them, the people that make those tools, to to get to the market. Mm-hmm. So that we've seen a lot of support from companies that are they're in that space. And what we see in the long run in terms of surgical robots, which is what's happened in a lot of spaces, is that the hardware becomes more commoditized and more of the exciting stuff happens with software. So we've set up to be a lot more of a software focused company where we're trying to keep the hardware as minimal as possible. And our business model will likely, though we're still finalizing this, align with more of a software type model where when we, for example, add a new procedure to the platform, it's not going to be much of a hardware change. We're going to have a software module that kind of is trained on that other procedure. And so it's mostly going to be software upgrade based as we improve the platform. We'll probably have new little adapters for different tools, but that's really going to be it. We see robotics going this way. I know that's contrarian. This disposables model is believed to be the way that robotics should work. I think as a software company, anyone who's built hardware in the medtech world knows that it's a slow and painful process. Mm-hmm. So even if, you know, people can make the case that we are leaving money on the table by not making disposables, we can make software, which is higher margin, and then also move much faster because we're focused on the software and don't have to go through all the additional development and testing that comes with building additional hardware. As you increase complexity, it just gets harder almost exponentially. The more and more stuff you actually have to build and ship.
But at the end of the day, are you selling both the software and the system, or are you selling just the software? Do you see? I mean, do you sell?
Yeah, there'll be a base platform. It's kind of like, I mean, a lot of car analogies. We liken it to Tesla, where you buy the car, then there's software upgrades. Gotcha. It's even more focused on the software side though than that, where they'll buy the robot at the beginning, and then they're mostly going to interact with it like a software platform from there on out. Where, yeah, it's not going to be a whole lot of excess hardware as we keep growing and expanding. It's just going to be a lot of software upgrades.
Interesting.
So if you buy this in the Gen 1, you can expect to get a lot of interesting stuff coming down the pipe later on.
Okay. Well, sounds great. Well, we look forward to hearing the story at Device Talks West. Nick, thanks for taking some time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to be here again.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Great to have you here. I hope to see you at Device Talks West. Again, it's happening October 16th and 17th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Use the code DTPOD25 to save 25%. For podcast purposes, make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. Leave a comment or a rating on your podcast player and give us some stars. It really helps people find the podcast, and they're kind of fun to read. So maybe I'll start reading some on air. Like they do in some of the podcasts that I listen to. So again, please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. And do me a favor, share this episode on your social media channels. And make sure you connect with me on LinkedIn. Make sure you connect with Kayleen Brown on LinkedIn. Make sure you connect with Chris Newmarker on LinkedIn. And of course, follow Device Talks, Mass Device, and Medical Design and Outsourcing on LinkedIn. We put out lots of great content, thoughts, and perspectives. And I know you'll have a richer LinkedIn experience if you do it. So that's a wrap, folks. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.